We have three speakers today who are going to tell us about efforts to roll out Internet 2 and broadband throughout Tennessee. We'll start with Internet 2. Predrag Radulovic is a network engineer with the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, specializing in wide area, optical, and wireless networks. He is the initiator of the Tennessee-sponsored educational group participant project with the Internet 2, providing access to the high bandwidth and performance national network to schools, museums, libraries, and other qualified organizations. Thanks for coming, Predrag.
Thank you so much. And, you know, we're going to first jump into, the high-speed networks, and then I guess towards the end of the presentations, other speakers will be talking how actually to get there. So we're kind of starting from the top and going to kind of tell you how to get there. Okay, so the part of the realizing of promise are these two organizations. So we didn't mention the NLR, but in fact there are actually two competing big organizations that are providing research and education community with a high bandwidth access. This is the Internet 2 network. It is a national research and education network in the United States. It is an organization, nonprofit organization, funded by a number of universities back in 1997, and today has over 200 member universities, primarily research one institutions, so the ones that get a lot of NSF grants and, you know, have supercomputers and clusters and so forth, and provide them high bandwidth access to this national infrastructure. National infrastructure is, of course, connected to international peers, and in fact, you know, there are over 50 other international networks that throughout Europe, Asia, Australia, and then they're only actually starting to connect states, countries in Africa. That is still kind of a very remote and very hard to get region with high bandwidth. So as you can see on the map, you know, Tennessee is on the map of Internet 2, and they have node in Nashville, Tennessee. However, currently we are connecting through Nashville, that's University of Memphis, and then also through Atlanta. And what are the services that, you know, Internet 2 network provides? As I said, you know, it was initiated by large universities who had need for this high bandwidth application. First, it came as an IP network, which is, you know, basically a general network like the one you have at home, which provides you general access to everything. You have one pipe, one connection, and it gets you pretty much everywhere in the world. However, on top of what commercial internet is providing, this research and education network provided some services that are not generally available on commodity internet. First of all, it's high bandwidth, you know, so you can immediately burst from each computer to a very high speed. And then there are some other services such as multicast that are generally not available in the market. Multicast is if you think about it, it's sort of a way how cable television distributes channels. So you're basically sending data in one way, and instead of you're sending only one stream from one source, like if you have a server and you want to broadcast to the whole world, basically server just sends one stream, and then this big network, you know, gets its subscribers. Subscribers want to see the view, and then this network of routers and switches kind of distribute the content. So it's a way to preserve, you know, resources, because network is only utilized one, and many, many users are receiving it on the end, as opposed to classical streaming, for example, when you're watching video at home from YouTube and so forth. Server is sending you a dedicated stream. So if another user wants to view the same, they have to replicate that stream. And, you know, so the more the users they are, the more bandwidth it's using. And multicast is a way to preserve the bandwidth and also to preserve the server. So the less servers we have, you know, that's, you know, ecologically better. So we don't consume as much power and then cooling and so forth. So it's a very cool technology. As I said, it's not still very widespread in the United States on the commercial market, but in countries like UK and other countries, like, for example, BBC's throughout the United Kingdom spreading their signal, and viewers can actually watch their shows pretty much for free, you know, most of them over this network and this advanced technology. Internet 2 provides also some dedicated service. So over the 10 years, we've discovered that this one network cannot be sufficient for all of us. So these supercomputers really, really, really need a lot of bandwidth. So we basically build separate networks just to serve them. And then as a freebie in the process, we because there is this fiber that is all over the place, and fiber can support multiple networks simultaneously. So we kind of separated, so some traffic does not, mingle with other traffic, and that way we can keep high, bandwidth users on their dedicated circuits, and then everybody else can share also pretty big pipes to do their applications uninterrupted by these high bandwidth applications. And also Internet 2 provides a commodity peering service, which is something that members are taking advantage of. So peering is something where you for no fee exchange traffic with big institutions. So usually it works that big organization peer with big organizations, and that's how the traffic gets exchanged. That's really how internet works. So, AT&T will peer with, let's say, Sprint, and they're not charging each other for the bandwidth because they know that at the end they have customers that are paying. So we higher education was able to peer with lots of these other entities at basically no cost or very low cost. So that service is available to members. Now, this service is in general not available to sponsored participants, so we don't want to be in business of selling the bandwidth, but there may be in the future opportunity for that to happen. And then as far as membership goes, I said there are primary participants, which are these large universities that are founding members. They're also sponsored participants, so that can be, particular individual institutions that have a need to connect to this high bandwidth network, and they may include, schools or research hospitals and stuff like that. But these sponsored participants are, as I said, individual organizations. So several years after the inception, Internet 2 founded the SEGP program, which is Sponsored Educational Group Participant. Basically, what that is, it opens Internet 2 to basically all nonprofit organizations. So if you are a library, if you are a research hospital, if you are a museum, you can basically get sponsored by the member universities in the state and get access to this network. And about 2 years ago, we have, with cooperation from between three entities, University of Tennessee, University of Memphis, and the Educational Networks of America, who was the K-20 provider for the state. We founded this Tennessee SEGP, and there are certain dues that, we decided to pay for all of you, as, of course, we get money from the state, so it's kind of used for a good purpose. And the fees that we have to pay to connect basically everybody is like $48,000 annually. So that's just membership fee. We still have, so everybody's covered, but you have to get to Internet too somehow. If you're an ENA, UT is peering with ENA, so we are providing Internet 2 access. So everybody on ENA already has access to Internet 2. The only problem with that is you're on the same pipe where your commodity traffic is going. So basically, you're still limited by paying, commercial fee versus, getting dedicated access, which is very, very cheap on this big infrastructure. So that, so the way to alleviate that is actually directly connect to one of the big universities. And I'll talk a little bit later, how that may work out. I also provided a couple of links, where you can learn about the organization. So for Internet 2, it's internet2.edu. And then about the SEGP program, it's a website at the University of Tennessee, www.ns.utk.edu, and then you follow the link for Internet 2 and SEGP. As I mentioned, there is another organization that similarly provide services to a research and education network community, and that's National Lambda Rail. It started actually much later after Internet 2, and the idea was that, everybody was talking about fiber. Why is fiber important? So higher education decided to follow, what some other countries have done. So universities went out and purchased fiber, and basically they control their infrastructure and therefore control the cost. Since we are nonprofit organizations, we don't have to, supercharge. We just need to cover the costs of the network. And that made these huge pipes available for a fraction of the cost. So sometimes, cost is estimated to be a tenth of what, in the commercial world you would be paying. So NLR basically bought or long-term leased about 11,000 miles of fiber throughout the United States, and it's completely operational and provides multiple services similar to the ones that I mentioned with Internet 2. So University of Tennessee participates in both, and for the IP services of the NLR, we connect through our regional connector, which is Southern Light Rail, another nonprofit organization that was founded by the Georgia Tech. And this is, you know, their national map. All the maps, you know, look, you know, similar. And if you're looking at the maps, you know, you can see that some areas of the country, you know, the networks don't go through. And you can see, you know, where the rural states are and where the interstates are. And sort of, you know, even on the national scale with the, you know, larger universities in some remote areas, I mean, it's also very difficult to get access. So it's not only a problem of, for example, in state, you have rural, you know, counties in the state of Tennessee, you really have rural states in the United States. And for them, it's also very difficult to get access to this fiber. So they get additional grants, and very often states helps fund something like this. So, you know, what can I do on this internet to an NLR that I cannot do on commercial internet? There are lots of things that you really cannot do. I mentioned this multicast. Multicast basically allowed us to view lots of educational channels from, as you know, most universities have their own like TV program, TV station, where there are a lot of, you know, resources for learning. And so basically with this, we are enabling the whole country to see the program if you are connected on internet to our multicast enabled. You can also do a much higher quality video conferencing. Then you can do also high-definition video streaming. So there are hundreds and hundreds, literally, all these channels available on Internet, too. You just basically have to know what you're looking for and get there, and, you know, the stream will show up on your screen if you have enough bandwidth. Bandwidth is the key thing. I mean, the last mile is always the problem. Universities are very fortunate. You know, we pay a lot to get that last mile and get high bandwidth. But I think with the spread of broadband, and some other following speakers will probably talk a little bit about that, I think we're on good track to get, you know, fiber cable providers, you know, AT&T in this state. I mean, they're, you know, fiber, they're realizing the importance of fiber and getting fiber to every community, because otherwise they cannot deliver high bandwidth, you know, internet. So they are forced to, you know, upgrade the networks for economical reasons. But there is also, you know, lots of benefits, not just, you know, the profits. I think the engaging the workforce, you know, economic development in communities where that have this are enormous. Unfortunately, you know, over the past 4 or 5 years, the United States has been sleeping. You know, lots of other countries, mostly because of deregulation, were able to, you know, make it very easy for communities to get fiber infrastructure in their area. And actually, communities are able to, you know, build infrastructure on their own. These are long-term, you know, investments. To lay, for example, 1 mile of fiber, you know, it costs about $70,000. Depending on the terrain and so forth. So that's a huge investment for a private company. You know, they have to be able, you know, I mean, they are tight, you know, they need to show profits every quarter and so forth. Communities don't have to show profits, you know. You know, you're on your community, and you know that, you know, you're going to have, you know, you're going to be living there for probably a long period of time, you know, or, you know, you will move, but somebody else will, you know, buy your house. So people realize that this is a long-term investment. When you build your house, you don't build it for a year. You know, if you build it, you build it for you to last for a long period of time. And fiber infrastructure is the same way. It's the same way as the road works or the railway or so forth. It's a long-term investment. You cannot expect return in a very short period of time. And the benefits of that are great. I mean, for example, you know, I mean, you know how much you're paying for your DSL or cable connection, and you're getting, well, if you're very lucky, maybe 5 megabits per second. In countries like Korea and Japan, I mean, you can get 100 megabits per second. So you can really watch high-definition video over your internet connection for maybe half of the price that we're paying here for 5 megabits. So of course, you know, the factor that doesn't help us is the density of population. I mean, the population here is not as densely as in some of those countries, so it makes it more, it's less cost-effective to spread these fiber networks and so forth. But again, you know, economic power, I think, should make it possible that you know, you can do this. And in fact, we are on track to do that. It's just taking a little bit slower than probably all of us want it to happen. So NLR Internet 2, you know, well, okay, so you can get to universities on this network. Like, what else is there on the, well, Library of Congress is on it, NASA. So if you're using, you know, in schools, you know, they may use some resources of NASA, United Nations, National Institutes for Health, Institute for Standards, you know, national labs are on that, and many international networks. So there is a lot of, you know, participants or networks that are peering with Internet 2 and NLR. You know, one of the novelty that, for example, UT students can do these days is actually they can have video link job interviews. So you can imagine, you know, that's sort of saving the cost to a company to interview you, and yet you have opportunity to see them and interact much better than you can, for example, do on the phone. So that's really an advantage, you know. And you know, I can think of, you know, maybe library can do that. If you had the high-speed bandwidth and these video, you know, setups, you know, cost maybe $1,000 for a decent, maybe not high-definition resolution, but a standard resolution, which is still pretty good. And, you know, people not only could come to the library to find the job, but you also could actually get a job or get a job offer. So, you know, that's something that I think is very interesting for communities. And also, you know, not only these nonprofit organizations are on Internet 2 and NLR, but also some of the commercial entities or content provider. Internet 2 and NLR peer with networks like Google, Akamai, Microsoft, YouTube. So a lot of the content can be offloaded to these much cheaper links. And you know, that really saves us the cost. Over the past, you know, years, I mean, universities are reporting that actually they're not continuing to buy more and more bandwidth from commercial providers. They're actually pretty stagnant. They are just offloading all the traffic to these other much cheaper networks. So that's pretty much, you know, so how do you get there? There is a state RFP bid that is coming out. Responses were due on April 1, and in probably about 2 months, the contract will be assigned. That should offer you more services that you had on current contracts. Metro Ethernet is hopefully something that you will be using in the future. You're going to be dumping the T1s if you have them in the library, because as we all know, you know, you have more bandwidth at home than in your library sometimes. So hopefully this Metro Ethernet will stimulate more usage of bandwidth and make it more affordable. This is a 10-year contract, so it's a long-term something. And we added E-rate to it, so, you know, the qualified institutions can do that. And if you are in, you know, one of the countries that has a college and university, try to contact them and try to, through them, connect to Internet too, because that's certainly more cost-effective for everybody. Thanks.
Thank you, Frederick. Next up, Steve Buttrey is Connected Tennessee's e-community project manager for the East Tennessee region. In this position, Steve manages Tennessee's Trail to Innovation, a statewide strategy that enhances the supply of available technology and broadband through mapping and research and mobilizes technology planning groups called e-community leadership teams. In this role, Steve is responsible for determining Tennessee County's current utilization of technology and making plans for the best way to utilize technology in order to improve local government services and provide better health care and education, ultimately helping Tennessee communities remain economically strong. Steve previously worked at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in Knoxville, where he served as a professional health care representative. Prior to his position at Pfizer, Steve was the co-founder of First Response of Tennessee and served for 6 years as the elected state representative for Tennessee's 18th district. Steve holds a bachelor's in political science from ETSU. Steve?
Okay. Is it 10 chairs that's sponsoring this session? Thank you for sponsoring this session. I want to congratulate you guys as well as Tennessee Electronic Library for getting their $1 million in funding for 2007. And from what I understand, it looks like, knock on wood, that funding will be recurring this year as well. And that's something I'm proud to say. When I was in the legislature, I always tried to support that. And realizing, especially now that I'm out in the communities every day, realizing how important libraries are to not only metropolitan areas, but especially in the rural areas. Some rural areas, that's literally the only place that people can go, or one of the few places people can go to get broadband access, or that's a lot of times their first exposure to technology or even computers, period. So thank you very much. You're an integral part of what we do, what we're trying to do with Connected Tennessee and with Connected Nation and other states. So we really appreciate you. And if you haven't heard from me, chances are you will, depending on what county you are from. Yeah, you are, the libraries and librarians are always, along with the schools, their technology officers are always invited to participate in our projects. She went into what Connected Tennessee does, so what I'm going to do is share with you a little background information on your state so you know where we stand as far as broadband connectivity. The first chart I wanted to show you was as far as computer ownership. This is residence. We also, just a side note, we have all of this information is on our website at down at the bottom of the page, connectedtennessee.org. And there's a lot of information that you might find useful in what you do and just to show you where your area stands as it relates to the rest of the state. Computer ownership statewide is at 71%. Are most people from East Tennessee that are here? Where geographically? West Tennessee? Middle and East, so we've got everybody covered. The good news about Tennessee is statewide we're in pretty good shape as far as broadband connectivity and computer ownership, but there's still a digital divide that those rural communities and the urban communities, there's still a divide there, and that's where Connected Tennessee comes in and trying to help close that digital divide. Simple internet access, you can see where we are across the state, and everybody's within a few percentage points of being even there. I apologize for this slide. I couldn't get it to define any better. I had to take a snapshot of a PDF file, but basically when you look at computer ownership compared to the statewide average, the counties that are that have less computer ownership are the ones that are green and yellow. So you can see it's about what you would, those of you that obviously are familiar with your parts of the state, it's about what you would think. And when you start getting up into rural East Tennessee, Hancock County, where I'm originally from, there's significantly lower. And then when you start getting towards the metropolitan areas, you have that it starts to get darker blue, and that's where there are more residential computer ownership. And that can probably be directly tied to education level and income levels and things like that. Barriers to computer ownership. The red line there, don't need a computer. That's something that I think we can all do something about, and that's definitely one of the things that we're trying to do with Connected Tennessee is raise the awareness of technology and how it can benefit anybody no matter what they do, whether it's healthcare, libraries, definitely education, business and industry. But West Tennessee is a little lagging behind a little bit. Here in East Tennessee, we're in pretty good shape, but too expensive is not a huge factor, and using computers somewhere else, and that's obviously where libraries come in. That's usually when they say use computers somewhere else, it's either at a library or at their place of work. And this slide here just breaks that out, specifically showing where people use the internet. And you can see broken up by homework, someone else's home, or library. And libraries, a distant third in most of that, but it's still a big help for the communities. The way that we do this, I apologize, I'm stumbling through this. I'm used to having a laser pointer, and I didn't bring it up here with me to follow along. I like to have something with my hands, but usually when we go into a community, the first thing that people think is that we're a new provider and we're going to bring broadband to them right away. The fruits of our labor will hopefully be better broadband access and adoption, but our main message is broadband is coming. We're a little bit behind other countries, but it is coming. We want to make sure that the community is ready for it by awareness of applications. From there, you want to make sure that you have the availability, and affordability ties in with that as well, because it doesn't matter if how much access you have to something if you can't afford it. I mean, you can want a Mercedes all day long, but if you can only afford a Volkswagen, that's what you're going to get. So with the deregulation and competition, hopefully that price will come down. So this is what our e-community leadership teams are made up of. As you can see, libraries have their own sector. We chose not to tie libraries in with K-12 or education. We wanted to break them out separately because they're a big part of the technology assets of a community. What we do is we come in and we start out by benchmarking each of these nine sectors that you see up here, by inviting representatives from each of those sectors as to where they are today in their technology use, their broadband adoption, and where they would like to be, and then come up with actionable steps to get there. The next step after we do the benchmarking, part of the process, we inventory the resources that they have. That's obviously part of benchmarking where you are today, community websites, and we share with all parts of the state broadband stories from people that may be in that particular sector that person is in, to show them how broadband can impact their life. How can you guys help what we do? I would just encourage you, if you receive an invitation from us to attend one of our kickoffs or our benchmark meetings, encourage you to participate in that and help us to raise the awareness of the importance of technology. And I think you're already doing that. I know that in every, just about every library, that's if there are computers in a community, you're usually going to find them in a library. And if there's broadband, it's usually going to be at a library. And with that, I will take any questions, I guess, at the end. But I want to make sure I leave plenty of time for Computers for Kids, which is a program I don't talk about a whole lot, because every time I bring it up, the next question is, when can we get it in our community? So I'll let Heather take care of that.
Thank you, Steve. As Policy and Program Development Coordinator, Heather facilitates the development of Connected Nations technological programs and policy initiatives that support Connected Nations' mission of promoting economic development through the uses of technology. Heather also serves as program manager of Connected Tennessee's Computer for Kids program and Connect Tennessee's No Child Left Offline program, launched in October 2005. Heather earned a master's degree in computer science from Kentucky State University in Frankfort, Kentucky. She previously received a master's in public administrations and a bachelor of science in computer science from Kentucky State. As a graduate assistant, Heather assisted with several projects at the university, including the implementation of the video-based e-learning system designed to help personnel development. Heather.
Well, I'm really honored to be here just to talk about the Computers for Kids initiative. Computers for Kids actually started in Kentucky as No Child Left Offline in 2005. And basically, the idea behind No Child Left Offline was to place computers into the hands of underprivileged kids. What we had done in Kentucky was pretty much a similar kind of assessment as one that Steve was talking about, in terms of going into the communities and figuring out where people were in terms of availability, usage, and just basically computer literacy. And so after we analyzed this, we found that there was an adoption issue in Kentucky, which is pretty similar to the issue that's here in Tennessee. The underprivileged families were not using computers. They were not computer literate, which was, You know, we live in a technology age, and in order for you to be competitive in the global industry, you have to have computer skills. Walk into Walmart and ask for a job application, and what do? They point you to the computer, meaning you have to have maybe the most basic computer skills just to get the most basic of jobs this day and age. So it was very essential that we address that somehow. So I'm just going to go through really quickly some results that we found, which looking in Connected Tennessee's research, we broke down those research by income and by households that had children in them. And on this slide, you see that with families earning less than $25,000, only 50% of those had computers in the household. And, you know, the other 50, that's pretty disturbing, because what that means is from that time that the child gets off from school and the local library closes, then they have no opportunity to do school research. They have no opportunity to do everything else that a child needs to be doing in order to compete with a more privileged child. But as you can see, in the more privileged households, it was at 92%, which was pretty good for Tennessee. And then you can look at the data for internet connection at home. And if you look at these results, broadband usage was at 54%, which was pretty disturbing for Tennessee, or for a person like me who pretty much lives on technology. I know if I have to pay my bills, having to travel down to Tennessee, I had to MapQuest my directions. I had to pay my bills today. I have to email friends and family and coworkers every few hours. So I have to have that internet connection in order to do things instantly and just to get through my day. And thinking that 50% of the population are not able to do this is pretty alarming for me. I don't know about you. Barriers to computer ownership, looking again at income levels, one of the biggest barriers for low income, which is different from, you know, when you look at it from a statewide point of view, you had the price of the computer being a major barrier, which a lot of times the belief is that the barrier is availability, but actually the cost of the computer itself is a bigger barrier, which also was one of the principal ideas that led us to create No Child Left Offline and Computers for Kids. And then, of course, the other one that disturbs me is the idea that I don't need a computer, this, especially with the global trend that I mentioned earlier. And then barriers to internet adoption, again, you had I don't own a computer as being higher. And also by income, you can see it's at 57%. So Computers for Kids was born. The idea of Computers for Kids is to place computers in the households of underprivileged families. And we do this through children, but you know, the underlying idea is once the computer gets into the household, it's not only for the child. It's an opportunity for everybody within that family to have access to all the global resources that we could talk about and keep going. And so far, you know, in terms of seeing whether we've been successful, we've had an opportunity to do some research in Kentucky to see whether are people taking these computers and signing up for the internet. And we did some research in Kentucky, and we found some very interesting results, which we did not expect. As you can see, there was a large increase in broadband adoption in the counties that we actually distributed computers in. As you can see, it's a major difference between the other counties that didn't receive any computers. And these are the poorest counties in Kentucky that were receiving computers. So you had like a 211% increase, five times, you know, the increase in those counties, which meant that it was working. The whole belief that underprivileged people are not going to sign up for internet, not true. Once you give them the computers, you establish, you let them know the importance of it. Because with our programs, it's not only about bringing the computer, but it's also about bringing awareness and making it a community effort. So once we go into a community, then we invite other organizations to participate. We've had schools provide security training. We've had schools actually do some of the distributions, and doing the distributions, then we encourage parents to come and attend some kind of training and hope that they leave with the understanding that this is not just something that they can use for entertainment purposes, but for something that can literally transform their lives. So with Computers for Kids, we're operating under the same principles. And at this point in time, we've actually been working with the Department of Children's Services in Tennessee. And through that, we're distributing computers to foster kids. And these are foster kids that, you know, under the most terrible circumstances, have managed to keep a pretty reasonable GPA, 3.0 and higher. And so what we're doing is we're working with making sure that we go into every region and distribute computers to those kids, laptops or computers. This will give them, you know, even more encouragement and maybe more of an opportunity with the circumstances they face. So, and one of the challenges that we face are funding. Every day, we're a nonprofit, so everything that we do is based on what we can get from our partners and foundation applications. So pretty much a lot of my time is spent sitting down writing foundation applications, which is the least favorite part of my job. But the best part of my job is being able to go back into these communities, in the rural communities that a lot of people do write off, and meet with these people and learn how the computer has changed their lives. And even some of the organizations, we also work with nonprofit organizations, placing computers in them, especially in urban type communities where the community center is probably the place where kids can go for homework assistance and just to be safe and out of the streets. And we've done some of those too. And with those, the results are amazing. You have these organizations having 20 kids coming in to 60 kids coming in, because now they can actually get help that's more than just a tutor sitting next to them, but somebody showing them how they can get to what they need. In terms of how libraries can help, well, like I said, Computers for Kids is a community effort. And so when we go into the communities, we don't live there, and we're not always there to provide that support. So in terms of being the people in the community that have operated historically as the technology cores of, especially, I think Steve mentioned that, especially in rural areas, then, we're always welcome for those kind of partnerships with libraries. And also libraries using internet too can be the centers where interesting projects can occur. You know, via internet too, you can do high definition video conferencing. Maybe a librarian in Davidson can be talking to people in, I don't know, Far East Tennessee. But if you open up the community and give people to do remote instrumentation and a lot of other things that you can do using internet too at the library, and you know, with the way things are going and getting fiber to these communities, then maybe you can broadcast some interesting projects from the library into the community where the children and families don't have to travel to the library but can participate in library initiatives. So there's so many opportunities with internet too, with Connect Kentucky working on availability. So I'm excited about the opportunities. And like Steve, we're hoping to bring Computers for Kids to every single county. So I may be in touch with some of you to say, well, I need help with this in this county, because I don't always know who to talk to. And that's the most challenging thing about getting into communities, is to establish that contact. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we can take some questions now, and I'll ask all the speakers to be up here where I can hand them the microphone. Who's got a question?
I knew that was going to come up. I appreciate the question. We do not have an official position on that, but no matter what happens legislatively or I don't think in the near future it's going to accelerate anything that wasn't already planned. Does that answer your question? I don't know how much faster this process will go as a result of any legislation, but we don't care how people get broadband, as long as they get it, whether they get it through cable or their phone provider or a fixed wireless provider. In my opinion, and Prodrig knows much more about the technology part than I do. I just try to be a pretty good facilitator. Fixed wireless is, in the meantime, before we get fiber to the communities, fixed wireless is a rather less expensive way to provide broadband access to rural communities, because you don't have to have that last mile, doesn't have to be fiber in the ground. Now, it doesn't provide you the bandwidth that you would need to do some of the things that we've been talking about, but at least does get you some broadband access better than dial-up. So, and it's got that affordable component. There's all kinds of things that go into affordability. One of the things I found interesting in our research is citing affordability as the reason you don't subscribe to broadband was about the same for people in households with that $25,000 and then households at the higher end of the spectrum. So I tend to think that for some people, it really is affordability. And, you know, if it costs anything, it's the difference between broadband and putting food on the table. That's a choice we don't want anybody to have to make. But for most people, it's a value deal. I compare it to cable TV. You can get every channel under the sun if you want to pay $200 a month. But most of us don't value every channel. We only subscribe to what we value, even though most of us could probably maybe afford that. Maybe $200 is a little bit high, but you see where I'm going. It comes down to, and if my theory behind that is that younger people just entering the workforce may be making less money, but they've grown up with broadband and they value it and they're going to subscribe to it, and people making more money might be on the back end, and they, so sorry, I tend to ramble.
We're officially out of time, but one more.
So, I mean, I understand. Like, there's, you know, the point is there's so much content out there that these universities are creating. I mean, there's so much that nobody ever outside the classroom sees. Those are learning opportunities. Like, on University of Tennessee, we have this, like, chemistry day. So kids have to go and, you know, see all the cool experiment stuff. Wouldn't it be great if we could have all the kids who could not travel maybe 100 miles to get to Knoxville to see that in rural Tennessee and just kind of get that science lesson that they maybe could not get in school because they didn't have, you know, the liquid nitrogen and stuff like that. So it's really important. There is so much content out there that is not being seen, and through Internet 2 and other, you know, research and education networks, I mean, this can maybe possible. And so if they cannot get it at home, maybe they can go to the library and get it there. So as long as in each community get this, at least one source of that, that really helps. Ultimately, it's best to have it at home. But maybe that the first step is to get it, you know, it's always, you know, we need to bring first fiber to the community and then spread it, you know, whichever technology or whichever provider was willing to do that beyond that. But getting that first step, maybe bringing that first Internet 2 link into a little town. I mean, that's the first step, and maybe library is the first place in town to get it.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.